If you don't already or haven't already, would you take out your copy of God's Word, open it up, power it up to Ruth chapter 1. We're beginning a new series today. Have that handy as we work through this passage. Happy Valentine's Day to you. I hope that your Valentine's Day was a good one. The 40-something of us who took part in the marriage retreat this past weekend, it was a really, really good time, and I'm just thankful to Carrie and Lori Workman and their leadership and the very many who serve behind the scenes to make that possible. Not sure how you feel about Valentine's Day in general. Different people have different opinions on the subject. Conan O'Brien, for example, tweeted this week, "A survey found that on Valentine's Day, men spend $87 more than women." He went on to add, i.e., a survey found that on Valentine's Day, men spend $87. Yeah, you'll get it in a minute. It's hard being a man. Unfair sometimes, but anyway. But if that's the worst we have to deal with, we're doing pretty good, right? Life is full of unfairness, inequity, pain, sorrow. There are three kinds of people in this room. Some people are in the middle of troubles. Some people are just coming out of troubles. And some people are heading into troubles. You fall into one of those three categories, I'm afraid. That's just part of what life is, troubles, right? And not all troubles are created equal. Some troubles are speed bumps along the way. Others are mountains to climb. And it seems that Christ followers are not exempt from troubles. I remember several years ago, I guess in her memoirs or something, when Mother Teresa revealed to the world, or it was revealed to the world, that she went, what she said was an entire decade of her life when she felt alienation from God. Mother Teresa. You read the Psalms, and you see that over and over again, the people who write the Psalms cry out to God, "Where are you? I'm going through this, Lord. I need you." And even Jesus on the cross, in the smack dab middle of the Father's will, quotes the Psalms and cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me?" When we come to the story of Ruth, it doesn't really begin as Ruth's story. It gets there eventually. But it begins with the story of a woman, Naomi, who is in one of those mountain kind of troubles of life. Ruth begins by saying the story took place in the days when the judges ruled. This was the time between Moses and the kingship, between Mount Sinai when the law was given and when Saul and David became kings of God's people. It's a time of troubles, the time when the judges ruled, sort of like the time of the Old West when there was really no law, there was no king, there was no control, and God's people would get in trouble, and then somebody would ride up on a horse in a white hat. When the people turned back to God, God would send them a rescuer, someone like Gideon or Deborah or Samson. The story goes on to tell us there was famine in the land, no food. This is very common in the ancient Near East, common in the Old Testament, common in the lives of the saints, famine. Just like famine, literally, metaphorically, coming in our own lives. And these famines would cause movement. The story goes on to say that this family that it's going to focus on is from Bethlehem. And immediately, the people who read the story, who read the story when it was first written or heard the story when it was first spoken, when they hear the name Bethlehem, their mind goes to this village of David, their first king. Their ears perk up. This is going to be an important story. Of course, we, 3,000 years later, when we hear the name Bethlehem, our minds automatically go to a stable, right? With a star shining over it and shepherds coming to visit a baby lying in the manger. Bethlehem is the city of David, but it's also the city of Christ the Lord. And so our ears perk up because we know this is an important story. It's a story of how David came to reign, and more importantly, how Jesus came to reign as our king. But this story starts with tremendous, tremendous trouble. Naomi is first forced to leave her home, and not just her home, but her homeland. The story tells us that her husband, Elimelech, or however you want to pronounce the name, decides there's no food here, we've got to go find it across the border. And so off they go. I say Naomi was forced to leave her home because she was forced to leave her home. She probably had not much say in the matter. And so off they go. And they arrive in Moab, and the story's not definite, but it seems it's not too long before Naomi loses her husband. Not only is food scarce, but her husband is now gone. And to grasp the enormity of that, it's not just now she will miss her husband, which obviously she will. Obviously, there's the hole in her life and in her heart anytime that that happens. But she's also lost her chance for a livelihood. In the ancient Near East, much more than in the 21st century United States of America, a woman's ability to just survive was strongly attached to her ability to have a husband. And so Naomi finds herself a widow. But that's not all. The story goes on to say that soon she loses her two sons, her two and only two. And a widow was not so much on her own as long as she had sons to take care of her. And suddenly, really without explanation, her two sons are gone. And Naomi's bitter. You can understand why she would be. You read the rest of the story and she begins to blame God, and we can shake our finger at her, but at the same time we can understand why she would be angry, be bitter when this has happened. She says it's God who has done this. Some people have agreed with her. Some people have said the bad things that happened to Naomi was the judgment of God, that they never should have left the homeland. They never should have left the promised land. They never should have gone to Moab to try to find food. Shame on them, and God got them. Some people have seen the 10 years that Naomi's sons were married to their wives, the Moabites, and said, and they didn't have any children, and that was the judgment of God. Was it the judgment of God? Naomi seems to think so. At least she says that God did this. The text doesn't say yes or no. The people who say yes sound a little bit to me like Job's friends who come up and say, "What'd you do?" I tend to think it wasn't her sin or her husband's sin or even her son's sin. I think this all happened, in the words of Jesus, in order that God might be glorified. Friends, may I suggest to you this morning that when it seems like you've been abandoned by God, it's very likely completely the opposite case. That a lot of times when we feel like that God has left us, then in actuality, God is in the middle of our lives working for even a greater purpose than we could possibly ask or imagine. It's exactly what's happened in Naomi's life. She's going to get a glimpse of it by the end of the story. But this story is the setup for the king coming. Not only that, this story is the setup for the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords coming. And in the moment when this woman feels like that God has utterly abandoned her, what is actually happening is God is setting things up to bless the whole world. Sometimes when it seems you've been abandoned by God, it's very likely completely the opposite. I mean, even Jesus demonstrates this. Jesus, the descendant that this story is setting up, when he's hanging on the cross and dying for us and making the way for the reconciliation of the universe to God, Jesus says, my God, why have you forsaken me? It's in the middle of God's will that Jesus feels the most forsaken of his life. But we should expect that, shouldn't we? Because aren't the stories that we like to read and the movies that we like to watch and the ones that we like to tell and repeat to our children and our grandchildren and talk about at family reunion, aren't these stories that we love? Stories that take people through hardship and trouble. It's the Olympics, right? What kind of Olympic story do we like? Do you like to hear the Olympic story, the champion who always had everything they needed and never had to get up at 4 a.m. to go practice anything and always had all the equipment provided and all the sponsorships they need and never had a setback, and then here's your gold medal? Don't we love those stories? No, we love the stories about hardship, overcoming adversity, being in the place where they felt like throwing in the towel, giving up, didn't know where the next day even was going to come from. But somehow, some way, they push through, they triumph. Who could have heard or watched the United States hockey team beat Russia 3-2? And not think about the 1980 Olympics, the miracle on ice, and all of the hardship and struggle that that team went through to win the gold. All of the turmoil that America was in at the time. I read this week the story of 24-year-old Caitlin Farrington from Idaho, who won the gold for America in the women's snowboard half pipe. The story was that her parents sold all their cattle so that she would be able to train and have the equipment. And they interviewed Caitlin after she won and had the gold medal around her neck. And she said, "I'm sure my parents don't miss those cows today." You know, sometimes there are days when we miss the cows. And we cry and we groan and we are bitter even towards God and say, "Why did you take my cows?" But is there a day coming? Is there a day coming? Friends, my own experience is that it's sometimes when I feel like, where in the world does God have me right now? What in the world is God doing with me now that God is doing God's greatest work? Somewhere around 13, 14 years ago, God called me and Kelly to Terre Haute, Indiana. After I met with my pastor in Fort Worth and he asked me, "Are you willing to go anywhere?" And I said, "Anywhere." And God sent me anywhere. But seriously, I mean, I was wondering what God was doing. Born and raised in Texas, and God sends me and Kelly on, you know, the foreign mission field, and, you know, sends us to a church that has been through rough, rough stuff. You talk about mountains, they've climbed them. And so we began to invest and to work and to hang in there, and look for God to work. And one of the issues at the church was the building. It just was. The church started out in an old refrigeration building, and you could tell. I mean, there was part of the church building they had added on to a sanctuary, and there was part of the church building that was pink. There's no other way to describe it. And, you know, no matter what we proposed to do or tried to do or researched to do, it just seemed like there was nothing we could do to improve the looks of that. And we had people tell us all the time, you know, people who would finally wind up in our church, they would say, I put off for the longest even coming to your church just because the appearance of the building was so offsetting, off-putting. I mean, some people referred to it as the Pepto-Bismol building or the Pepto-Bismol church or the pink church. And so, you know, we knew this was an issue that we needed to address, and at the same time, we're in this congregation that has dwindled, and there are serious gaps in the age groups that were involved in the church. Because the attendance had dwindled down so much, you know, there wasn't all this money that we could just throw around and improve the appearance of the building, and you know, but we hung in there. And when we would bring up the issues about the appearance of the building and what that spoke to our community about what was going on, because we felt God was moving, and God was moving, and we wanted the outside to reflect what was going on the inside, there was opposition. There were people who, you know, and it's true, churches sometimes can get focused on buildings and structures, but this was not that situation. And so we hung in there, and pain and suffering. God, what are you doing? I mean, it's obvious that we need to do something about this. And God, why do you have us here? It's such a struggle. And, you know, I don't have much going for me, but one thing I do have is the spiritual gift of stubbornness. And so I was just determined, I am going to hang in here and, you know. And finally, after years, and just what seemed like decades, it wasn't decades. I was there for 11 years, so it couldn't have been decades. But what seemed like a long time, we finally were even able to have the discussion. What do we need to do about the property that is our tool to reach this community? And finally, we decided, you know what? We can't make this decision on our own. We're going to bring in a consultant. We brought in a consultant, and the consultant came in and said, guess what? You got to do something about your property. You know, the definition of an expert is somebody who comes from 50 miles away or more. And so it's like, yeah, we need to do something. I'm going, great idea. Wish I had thought of that. But anyway, you know, sarcasm in my pocket. But anyway, so the church was up and we are going to do something about this. And we made plans and we began to look around the community and we looked for space and we looked for, you know, another building that we might be. And everything was just falling through. I had a friend in Marshall, not Texas, but Marshall, Illinois, which is right across the border from Terre Haute. And he had been in his situation half the time that I had been, even less. And he comes up to me one day and he says, you know, guess what? Our church is going to buy the old Walmart and we're going to renovate it. And I'm going, oh, praise the Lord for you. You know, it was so hard not to be jealous in that situation. You've been there how long, and I've been here how long? But we looked, and the church was on board, and there were just no doors opening. And one day I can remember very clearly, my wife comes up to me and says, you know what, I just think that you are David, and the next pastor is going to be Solomon. You're preparing the ground, and the next guy is going to make it happen. And it was just like a word, my wife, the prophetess. And then God opens up this door to call us to Marshall. And the next guy comes in, and guess what? He's Solomon. The door opens wide. It was amazing how it goes down. They have the door open to buy this almost brand new church building. They're moving in this month. I'm FaceTiming with my friend in Marshall, Illinois, and going, they're getting into their building before you're getting into yours. He didn't like that too much. But anyway, we had a good laugh. And stubbornness just paid off. Sometimes God works when we think, what's going on here? What are you doing with us? Why here? What's going on? Why not this? God works. God was doing it in Naomi's life, whether she realized it or not. God was doing it in Naomi's life. And friend, I don't know what deep dark you may be in this morning, but is it possible that God is doing a work that's even going to last for centuries through you, through your situation, through your life? So on the story goes, Naomi wakes up one day and says, look, I don't have a husband, I don't have sons, I'm going back home. She's heard that God has opened up the floodgates of heaven again and bringing back food. And so she says, we're going to go back to the promised land. They load up, they're on their way. And on the way, Naomi begins to try to talk her daughter-in-laws out of going with her, because the daughter-in-laws are committed. Daughters-in-law are committed. They're going to go with her. Naomi tries to talk them out of it. The question is, did Naomi want Ruth and Orpah to come back with her? And the answer is obviously not. What were her motives? Probably mixed. She gives good reasons for them not to come back. I mean, the practice of the day would be if her sons passed away, then the daughters would marry other sons from her. And she says to them, it's crazy. I can't even, I'm past the age of childbearing, but even if I could, I don't have a husband. And even if I did, if I got, you know, pregnant today, were you going to wait for the boys to grow up and then marry? It just doesn't make good sense. Girls, your livelihood depends on whether or not you are married. You have no hopes of that here. Go back to your people. Go back to your home. Find a husband there. I pray that God will give you a husband there for your own well-being, for your own safety. Girls, go back home. Twice they refuse. The third time, Orpah, the other daughter-in-law, says, okay, it makes good sense. It makes good sense for their future provision. It makes sense for their survival. Orpah says, okay. Some people have hammered her for this decision too. I think that's not fair. In fact, there are a lot of rabbis who commented on this story, and they kind of expanded the story, and they said, you know, as Orpah was heading back home, she was attacked by wild animals, No, she was just doing the reasonable thing. Not to be faulted in any way, shape, or form. But look how Ruth responds. The first words we hear out of her mouth alone, she and her sister-in-law have talked together, but this is the first comment from her mouth. Verse 16, do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts me from you. What commitment! What dedication! It makes every bit of sense. Humanly speaking, every bit of wisdom points to Ruth to go back home. But her faithfulness overrides everything. Friends, when you have every reason to abandon, choose to be faithful. I think it's so beautiful, this choice that Ruth makes, and later on, the descendant who would come from her, the one who is both God and man. The man part from Ruth says to us, I will never leave you nor forsake you. God's people, Christ's people, never leave, never forsake. So notice this biblical family here, friends. A biblical model of family. Two widows, a mother-in-law and daughter-in-law. Think God can't use your family? Think God can't use you because you come from a family that may not appear on the cover of a magazine? Think again. Notice that God blesses two women who are in a committed, loving relationship with each other. Or at least Ruth toward Naomi. Don't you agree? I mean, we even quote Ruth in weddings all the time. This is not between a husband and a wife. This is a daughter-in-law and mother-in-law, and we read it at weddings all the time. Now, some of you look a little nervous. Oh, did I imply that this was a sexual relationship? I didn't mean to, because the text doesn't. Now, some people have read it into it, the text, but it's not. See, I think that we have a problem in 21st century America. We read sex into everything. I was reading a wonderful, wonderful book. Doris Kearns Goodwin's Team of Rivals, the story of Abraham Lincoln and how he put his cabinet together. Something that struck me as I was reading the book was how the men of the day talked to one another and wrote to one another. There was a section where Goodwin was talking about William Seward, who was the Secretary of State under Lincoln. In his 20s, he lost a very close friend whose name was David Burden, or Burdan. David contracted tuberculosis when he was traveling around Europe. And William Seward later told his wife that he had loved Burdan as never again could he love in this world. Is that a statement that could be made in the United States of America, 21st century? Without sexual connotations? Edwin Stanton, who would serve as Lincoln's Secretary of War, in 1846 wrote Salmon Chase, who would become Lincoln's Secretary of the Treasury, because they had both lost wives around the same span of time. Stanton had lost a daughter. Both had lost close family members, so they bonded. And Stanton writes a letter to Chase, and he says, "Since our pleasant intercourse together last summer, no living person has been oftener in my mind, waking or sleeping. For more than once I have dreamed of being with you. The strength of my regard and affection for you I can thus tell more freely than were we face to face." Would a man say that to a man today? I haven't thought of anybody more than I've been thinking about you. Lincoln, after he appointed James Speed as Attorney General, who was Joshua Speed, Lincoln's really good friend, his brother, said this about James Speed. "He was a man I know well, though not so well as I know his brother Joshua. That, however, is not strange, for I slept with Joshua for 4 years, and I suppose I ought to know him well." Abraham Lincoln, President of the United States. And we immediately begin to read sexual connotations into this, but it's interesting because Goodwin makes the point, in the early 1800s, it was extremely common for young men to leave their families to go and advance their careers. And they would go to these cities that were booming, and they would bond with one another. They would lodge with one another. Private rooms were almost unheard of, a luxury that almost no one had. And they would bond with one another, and they would their friendships would be so transparent and intimate that they would speak in these passionate terms. Goodwin quotes historian Donald Iacovone, who studied these passionate and devoted relationships, and said, "The preoccupation with elemental sex reveals more about later centuries than about the 19th. I put it to you this way. You know those ink blot tests that sometimes psychologists show people? Look at this and tell me what you see. And the point of that is what you see in the ink blot is really just an ink blot, but what you think you see says more about you than the ink blot. So you have the story of the guy who refused to go to the psychologist anymore because he was tired of him showing all those dirty pictures to him. The pictures say more about the guy than they do the pictures. Why is it that we can't read a story of Ruth and Naomi without reading something sexual into it? Sexual behavior. Why do people do the same thing with Ruth's descendant, David, when he has a close friend, Jonathan? who he tells, your love is better than the love of women. He's not being, there aren't sexual overtones there. Read David's story. His issues were in another direction. And even Jesus, who had the one he loved, the disciple he loved, probably John. People read stuff into that. It says more about us than it does about them. Why is it, friends, that we have no place in our hearts for these kind of relationships? I think we're losing something. I think the faithfulness that, and the dedication and the devotion and the passion that exists between Ruth and Naomi here is something we desperately need to recover. To stop being so preoccupied with sex. Yes, it's important, but it's not the most important thing, and it's not the only driving force in our lives. And in a world when less than half of marriages last, whenever the average American moves every 5 years, the average pastor stays 2.5 years, the average congregation member stays how long? I don't know. We need faithfulness in a big way. Lastly, I want you to notice Naomi's words and actions when she goes to Bethlehem. It's a woe is me, and again, I'm not throwing stones at her. I think I would be pretty upset if I were in the same type of situation. But she gets back, and Bethlehem's all in a stir, and is this Naomi? Wow, you know, kind of a thing. In verse 20, she says to them, don't call me Naomi, which means pleasant. Call me Mara, which means bitter, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me? So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law with her, who returned from the country of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of barley harvest. I'm not going to throw stones at Naomi, but I can't help but wonder that Ruth might be standing there and hearing this tirade. The Lord has brought me back empty. And she's just made this tremendous declaration of faithfulness and this tremendous step to come back and pledge her life to help this mother-in-law make it. And I can't help but wonder if Ruth is not thinking, what am I, chop liver? But she just ignored. Pretty much the rest of the story, she's ignored. The people of Bethlehem don't even acknowledge her, and it's most likely because, and the text makes a point of calling her the Moabite. It's because of her race. And Israel had all the reasons in the world not to like the Moabites. I mean, they started in a shady way, Lot and his daughter. They opposed the Israelites when they were trying to come to the promised land. They wouldn't let them pass through. The king of Moab hired Balaam, the prophet, to try to curse them. And whenever that didn't work, they sent their women in to seduce the men. And that caused a lot of trouble. Even in the period of the judges, there was a king, Eglon, who was the king of Moab, and he oppressed the people. They needed one of those gunslingers to come and rescue Balak, the left-handed guy. The left-handed guy came in and rescued things. They were trouble for Israel all through their history. They had every reason not to like the Moabites. But shame on them. Look who's standing right there, Ruth. And they ignore her. Worse, they show contempt to her. Friends, if we're going to be Messiah's people, Jesus' people, we must refuse to abandon the outsider. Because God loves outsiders. Did you know that? God loves immigrants. Loves them so much, God became one. And left the glories of heaven for our sake. And lived in Nazareth, of all places. When people are in troubles, it's tough. When people are in troubles and the outsider, It's impossible. The story's left hanging. Will someone help this outsider in a town that ignores or is hostile to these Moabites? We've got to read the rest of the story. Will someone help the people in Marshall who need help desperately but may not have the support that you have and continue to enjoy? Well, that's for you to decide. That's for us to decide.